The Shear today is sponsored by Darlene Herman in loving memory of her mother Dorothy. Dvorah Bat Chaim V'Rachel, the Earth side, is Bet Shvat. Also, Lerfuat Hayela Daniel Shlomo Ben Layash, Refuah Shlema, and other people who need a refuah should also be included, that the shear should be for their in their merit, in their zchut. Okay, so let's learn. There is a major problem with, again, a great deal of the Mefarshim can't ignore, and therefore we're not going to ignore it either. And let's begin in source number one. It's Perek Zayin. There were a bunch of other places that we could have begun also, just by I don't know if any of you have ever used the app or the website, really, Al HaTorah. But if you look, they on this idea of that God hardened his heart, they gave me all of these different verses, and there may actually be more. I'm not saying they didn't do a good job, but they may have limited themselves to particular terminology. So there's at least all of these places to look, which you see underneath in this source over here. But on top of that, as I said, there are other issues as well that where God does this. So let's go back. And by the way, if you're not familiar with Al HaTorah, I'll say that again, it's at the very end over here. If you're not familiar with it, it is absolutely a wonderful website in terms of all kinds of Torah resources. So starting in the first source, Vayomar Shema Moshe Ra'e Natatiha Elohim Liparo Va'aronachicha Yeh Nivi'echa. So there will be some intrigue what the word Navi means in this context, although we should keep in mind that the word Navi in its basic level is Niv Svatayim, somebody who speaks. God speaks them and they speak, so it is a speaker for somebody. It doesn't literally have to be your prophet, it could be your spokesperson. And if I'm not mistaken, the Targum Onkelos translates this as Meturgaman, the person who will translate, but not just translate, your speaker. Atat taber et kol asher atzav veka, va'aron achicha yidaber el paro, which is essentially telling us what we just now read, v'shilach b'nei zol miyatzo, and then paro will send him away. And that sounds great, meaning if we ended right there, everything would be wonderful. But then we get to Pasuk Gimel, v'ani akshat leiv paro, but I'm going to harden his heart. V'rbeiti et atotai v'tmoftai v'eret t'trayim, I'm going to increase the signs and wonders in Egypt, in the land of Egypt. V'yo lo yishma leichem paro, and paro's not going to listen to you. V'natatich et yadib m'trayim, and I will raise my anthropomorphical arm or hand in Egypt. I'm going to set them free with great judgments. And Egypt will know then that I am God, when I raise my hand in Egypt, and I will bring Israel out. And they did what they were told. Now, what we have to appreciate is that redemption is frustrating. And the reason that it's frustrating is because we want immediate gratification. And the immediate gratification is lacking over here. And it's lacking because God is telling us that there's going to be this back and forth. You're going to leave, but I'm not going to let it go so quickly. And that's part of what should be concerning us, is why does it have to be so slow and so deliberate? I mean, let's remember something. And I'm saying this now as I raise the larger question. The larger question is, how could God do this and cause Paro's heart to be hardened? Which essentially, the way the question is formulated by many of the Rishonim, and maybe we'll even see a midrash about this, is essentially that God is taking away Paro's free will. So then why, you know, how can God do such a thing to take away his free will? So I do want to remind you of something, and maybe actually put this into a larger context. One of the things which is always interesting to us, and I say this in plural, is that we make a comparison between Sefer Bereshit and Sefer Shemot. And we have to ask what kind of things are the same and what kind of things are different. So there, if I were to use a Bereshit model to solve this particular problem, and what I mean by a Bereshit model to solve this problem, what I am implying is that if in Sefer Bereshit we had God wanting to do something, and God wanted someone to do something, God would simply use what we would call back in Brooklyn, certainly in Bensonhurst, we would call it mafia tactics. that God makes him an offer that he can't refuse. And we saw God do this a number of times back in Bereshit. I mean, God tells Avimelech, he says, you're a dead man. That's it. You're dead. So, but notice something. Was anybody all troubled back over there? You know, oh my God, what happened to Avimelech's free will? Well, he had free will. He can die or he could acquiesce. That's free will. And God really did the same thing to Lavan. And to a great extent, God did the same thing to Paro. And I strongly suspect, and this we learned a couple of weeks ago, I strongly suspect he did the same thing to Esav. I think that there are all kinds of micromanaging where God is in getting involved in people's feelings and telling people how it is that they're supposed to behave and what it is that they're supposed to be doing. So if you, again, just going back to Bereshit, it wasn't that God never took away people. Of course God took away people's free will. He told them what they had to do. So again, just think of that for a second. But there's something else which is missing in Bereshit, which does exist over here. And that is in Bereshit, God never gave anybody, and now what's the end of the sentence going to be? He never gave anybody a mate. He never gave anybody a staff. He never, and I hope you remember how you say the mate in Aramaic, chutra. You can't understand the God, the Chad Gadya without that. That God never gave in anybody's hands this ability where God subcontracts and said, I'm going to put you in charge now. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Sar, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, and you can keep on going, never perform any miracles. It's not even within their frame of reference that a person can do miracles. Yes, God does the miraculous when God feels like doing the miraculous, but that's the prerogative of when you're God. So God could upend and turn over the city of stone and do things which are against nature. God has the ability of causing this major flood to come. But it's not like God gave Noah a piece of wood and say, now pick up this wood, put down this wood, and go and do something, and so on. Which means the big difference between Sefer Bereshit and Sefer Shemot is that God does himself all of the miraculous, and God allows man to do the miraculous once we get over here. And maybe that's a part of what we just now read. We just now read that Moshe is going to become like a god to Paro, and Aaron will become his Navi. So I'm just pointing out that instead of just looking at the words over there, there may be this whole other side to it. Now, of course, what happens to somebody like Paro, who is a self-serving god? He believes he himself is a god. What happens when somebody has more power than him? So what happens at that moment? Does he still have free will? Again, I'm just raising the question, is what exactly does the loss of free will mean? Or what? How do we lose our free will? But I am getting ahead of myself. This question, which I'm going to say it again, has caused various authorities to look for all kinds of responses and explanations and answers. How could this possibly be? And the question really begins, because we would like to believe that we have this inalienable right to free will, and that God created us free will, and God had to create us free will. Let me actually restate all of this in a slightly different way. If we did not believe in free will, then religion becomes an absurdity. The only reason that religion makes any kinds of sense is because we can make decisions. If all that we were animals behaving based upon instinct, and everything we would do is based upon instinct, then we have zero responsibility. And I hope that all of us believe that we have the ability of making decisions in life. By the way, I am willing to say that, you know, people can continue to debate the interaction between nature and nurture. I accept that completely, that we are impacted by the nature, by our DNA, and we're impacted by the places that we were raised and how we were raised. All of these are impact us, but it doesn't, at the end of the day, become the 100% reason that we do certain things. We still have the ability of making informed decisions. And I admit it, that sometimes it's going to be very difficult to make certain decisions because of so much nature or nurture and or combination of nature and nurture. And maybe part of what we need also to understand is that our free will is not absolute. Free will does not mean that you can do anything and everything at any particular moment. Free choice or free will probably is more limited than we imagine sometimes, but we have the ability of making decisions, becoming closer to God or more estranged from God, which may be actually be the best definition of free will. And even after we make mistakes, we have the ability of using our free will in order to try to fix the relationship with God. And the last sentence I said is really quite important, not because I said it, because I'd actually try to explain something in the Rambam. The Rambam devotes more than one chapter in his laws, which is funny, laws of tshuva. I mean, it's just a very funny thing to have Hilchot Tshuva. I don't know if anybody for the Rambam ever imagined that tshuva should be subject to law. It's much more issues of philosophy and outlook and so on. And the Rambam decided in his laws of mitzvot, in his Mishnah Torah, to put a whole book of tshuva. But he dedicates more than a whole chapter to the problem of free will, understanding that that lack of use of free will is which causes sin. And proper use of free will helps us change and to fix the sin even after it was committed. So I'm saying it really is interesting, the centrality of free will that the Rambam has for the laws of in the laws of tshuva. But I'll say it again. This doesn't mean that we have absolute free will in every single case, but it means that we do have the ability of making decisions nonetheless. Going back two or three steps, if we had no free will, then religion is absurd. You can't command people of anything if they don't have the ability of making informed decisions on their own. And therefore, the Rambam has a problem, and he's going to share it with us. The problem is going to be people like Paro. So therefore, if we look in source number two, but actually before we look at the Rambam, I want to do one other thing first. I want to look at at Rashi. And it's interesting because people always do what I just now did. I was almost guilty of what I didn't want to do. And that is when we're bothered with free will, we go straight to the Rambam because the Rambam is a philosopher and the Rambam spells it out for us. Rashi actually says some real interesting things about this. And the reality of what I'm going to do today is I'm going to try to explain this Rashi. I'm just going to look at a bunch of other people as well. But let's look at the Rashi. He's on Perek Zayin Pasuk Gimel, which was Va'ani Akshe Leif Paro. So Rashi writes, Ani Akshe, Be'acha Shehershia Vitris Kenegdi. After he has been wicked and he has essentially, he's attacked God, as it were, resisted me. V'galui Lefanai She'enach Aruch Bumot Latet Leiv Shalem Lashuv. And I know that he would not derive benefit or pleasure from me, from Latet Lev Shalem Lashuv, by giving him complete ability to do tshuva. That's such a bizarre statement. Tov Shitkashelibo, it's good, it's preferable that I harden his heart. Leman Harbot Bo Totai, and now there's this other interest, in order that I can do more miracles, which very much seemed like the pshat in the psukim. V'tagir Atem et Gvurati, and then you will recognize my greatness. So essentially, we have two different audiences. One audience is the Egyptians, and the most important Egyptian is Paro, and the other audience is the Ivrim, or the Israelites, or Bnei Israel. V'chein midato shel Kadosh Baruch Hu, and that is God's way that God behaves. Mevi poranut al umot, he brings these terrible things upon the nations, kedei sheshmu Yisrael v'yiro, in order for Israel to grow. Now that, for some of us, can be a really disturbing statement. Essentially, they are these bit players in the movie who are going to get the brunt of all kinds of punishments just so that we can end up getting a lesson from this. Shenemar, Hichrati goyim neshamu pinotam, amarti alterioti, and so on. Ve'afa pichei, nonetheless, b'chamesh makot rishonot lo nemar v'chazek Hashem leiv paro. With the first five makot, it doesn't say that God hardened his heart, ela v'chazek leiv paro, rather that Paro hardened his heart. So I'm going to say it again. This Rashi has so many elements to it that it requires us really to unpack it almost word by word, certainly phrase by phrase. But what we're going to do first is we're going to look at the Rambam, we'll look at a couple of other sources, and then we're going to come back to Rashi and see how much Rashi really did say over here, because I think, I'll say it again, I think when it comes to philosophical issues, Rashi is very often either underrated or underappreciated. The Rambam, Perek Vav, we're going to look at Halacha Gimel, V'efsharich ta'adam chet gadol, l'chatim arbe, ad shitin adin lefnei dayan ha'emet. So he starts off in terms that people can sin. Again, people sin because we have free will. But we're going to skip along the way over here till he gets to the part that we are looking for. He writes over here that there are people, we'll look, see how far to get. V'chein hu omer, and we're going to skip the pasuk. Chatuber tzonam v'herbu l'fshoa, ad shenetchayvu l'mnoa mehem tshuva, shehi amar peh. He says there are going to be cases that people can sin so much until they lose the ability of doing tshuva. So, and lafichach katuv v'torah v'nichazek alef paro. And therefore it says in the Torah that I'm going to harden Paro's heart. Now again, this can be disturbing to some of us. I want to stop here. We're going to come right back to this spot in a moment. But I'm going to ask you a question, which is either a wonderful question or a terrible question. Because any time that you bring Hitler, in, or Nazis for that matter, into conversations like this, then it's generally going to be a sign of very weak thinking, because to use such an extreme example. But I think nonetheless, in this case, the extreme example is necessary to illustrate a point. Let's say that Hitler goes ahead and he kills his 6 million Jews. And then we get to the final day in the bunker. And he's in the bunker and he's trying to consider what his next step is. And he has this flash and he says, you know what, maybe I made a mistake. And maybe this is really not a good thing. And God, please forgive me for all the Jews that I've ever killed. And I'm very sorry for anything that I've done. And I'm such a horrific person. I'm actually going to kill myself to make sure that I don't do anything else which is wrong. And he fixes his relationship with God before he dies. Are any of you completely fine with that scenario? Okay, so this, you know, bygones. Everything is fixed, everything is done, and now he has his share in the world to come together with all the tzaddiki umot ha'olam, at least, and maybe even greater than that. Or does anybody find what I just now said completely, completely abhorrent and completely repulsive and theologically bankrupt? So that's what the Rambam just now said. The Rambam just now said that God gives us free will, and it is not a permanent right to be utilized in every single situation necessarily, and God has the prerogative to remove our free will at one point, which means this so-called philosophical problem, how could God take away free will from Paro? So the Rambam is saying God took away the free will from Paro because Paro no longer deserved to have free will. That's all. Which means it's his punishment. There is one issue that needs to be, you know, a little bit finessed, and that question would be, what is the status of sin committed when a person loses free will? Do they still have responsibility? Because that would, at face value, be wrong. If a person no longer had choice and had to sin, so they're programmed to sin, that would be a place that nonetheless we would have a theological difficulty, that why would this person be responsible? Why should they be punished for the sins that they've done when they no longer have free will? And I'm willing to read within the Rambam, and I think it's the right reading of the Rambam, that Paro's punishment is that he lost his free will, and therefore anything that he did prior to losing his free will, he's being punished for, but he's being punished so severely that God has taken away his option of fixing that. And therefore, from that point on, he's not punished, but he's no longer going to be able to fix anything wrong which he did. And that's pretty much what the Rambam does over here. And if you want, we can just, you know, look at it a little bit more and see how he says this about Paro. And he says a person can lose his free will. And he says, "V'nichazek atleif paro l'fi shechata me'atzmo tchila," because he sinned so much initially. "V'heran li'Yisrael hagerim ba'artzo," and he did such terrible things to the Jews who live in his land. "Shenemar havanich nitchak malo," which, by the way, is really the verse where he begins to speak about the final solution, as it were. Let's take them and let's kill them, and that's going to be an important point. "Natan hadin l'mno imenu tshuva ad shenifer imimenu." He needs to get punished, and in order for him to get punished, I'm going to take away the ability that he has of being sorry for what he's done, so that he will be punished. "Ulefichach chizek HaKadosh Baruch Hu et libo v'lama hashaleach lo biyad Moshe ba'omo lo shalach va'asei tshuva u'kfor amar lo Kodesh Baruch Hu she'ein ata mishaleach shenema v'tavadecha yadati v'ulam bavur zeh hemaraticha kidei lo'odia levoy ha'olum shebizman shemoneh HaKadosh Baruch Hu tshuva l'chotei einu yachol l'shuv. And that those last couple of words is where you see the Rambam saying what I claim that he said, that then the person will be punished for the things that he did initially, right? So the Rambam will accept this concept that free will is essential in order to have reward and punishment. But at some point, you can do so much bad that you lose your free will, and in order to get punished, but you only punish for what you've done while you still had free will. And as I said, that seems to be pretty much what the Rambam says. The Ibn Ezra, who is always interesting, over here in Shmot, we actually have two different Ibn Ezras. When I say two different, there's two different books, if you were not aware of this. The Ibn Ezra wrote maybe up to three different commentaries. Essentially, when he traveled from place to place, he rewrote his commentary. In 4, he writes, V'niakshah, yesh l'shol, im Hashem hikshah et libo, if God hardened his heart, ma pisho ma chatato, what was his sin and why was he guilty? V'atshuva, ki Hashem natan chachma la'adam, v'natab libo sechel, l'kabel koach elyon, u'losif al tovato, u'lochaseh merato. Is that God hardened his heart because he had the ability of making all kinds of decisions. Now, I'm not sure how much he explained just now, but then he says further, tam ekshat libo leman rabot muftai, and the reason he hardened his heart so that God can do more wonders. Rabbi Yeshua, maybe it's Rabbi Shaya, Omar, ki tam ekshat libo lesvola temakot, v'lo devar nechona. And he said the reason he hardened his heart was in order to be able to get more makot. And he goes, that's not correct. But we'll see more about this. In source 5, the other commentary of the Ibn Ezra writes as follows. Rabim tamhu v'amru. Many people questioned. Achar shashem ikshal libo, ma pisho ma chatato. V'anshe shikul hadat tishivu. People who were even tempered, as it were. Ki pirshu shamitz libo l'svol hatzarot. By the way, that's what he just now said he doesn't like. V'dati ta'adena b'pasuk. And he goes, but I, on the other hand, feel more comfortable with a different verse. And he quoted this in the previous commentary as well. Mi yitain v'yalu yivamzeh. So we don't know exactly what he's talking about. Although in source number 7, the Ibn Ezra is going to take us in a place that you didn't think that we were going to get to, and you're also not going to understand necessarily how he explained the whole thing, but he writes, this is his commentary to Dvarim Tevet Hanan, he writes, Vida, and you should know, Ki shorish kol ha'masim v'atnuot gzeirot Hashem, and this sounds very much like predeterminism, the things that we do are because God decided it. And all kinds of things that happen below happen because of all kinds of powers that exist above. Powers, by the way, in the plural, not necessarily meaning God, but rather what he's referring to is astrology. And he absolutely believes in astrology, and he believes that certain things are set up in certain ways in terms of who you are, what you do, and so on. And I'll say it again, and you read this, first of all, you get surprised. So I just want to take a moment and explain a little bit of this. I actually, a couple of weeks ago, as everybody already knows, I had a birthday with some people consider the number to be significant, but we had something on Thursday night, which was actually my Hebrew birthday, Esar B'Tevet. And we planned something then for Monday, which was going to be something very nice with the family, which got canceled because of Corona and because of a Seger and so on and so forth. But that Monday was actually my English birthday. So one of the things that I didn't get to speak about was where you see that an English birthday has any significance. And of course, I would have had to defend it, that there's some significance to an English birthday. So I want to show you Yerushalmi. Here you go. Anybody who ever said to you, oh, you can't celebrate an English birthday, there's no significance to an English birthday. The Yerushalmi would help us a little bit understand the Ibn Ezra, and then we'll move back to what we were up to. First, as I said, I already found the Yerushalmi. I may as well teach it to somebody. The Mishnah is, V'yakashe yirim Moshe yado. When Moshe lifted up his hands, V'gavar Yisrael. We saw this only last week. I hope you remember this. Is Moshe's hands cause the victory? No, it means that when Jews look up into heaven, look up to God in heaven, that's when we have faith and so on, that's when we are victorious. Then the Gemara says, Rav Yeshua ben Levi Amar, Amalek, which means this is Muhammad Amalek, Koshvan. Koshvan means they know Kishuf, Mechashef. Hoya. Maya Ose, what would they do? Hoya Ma'amid b'nei Adam biyom ginusiyashelo Lomar lo bimhera adam nofel biyom genusia shelo. He would put people on the day of their genusia. Of course, the question that you want to know is, what does genusia mean? So the Korban Eda, the commentary on the Rishami, writes, lemilchama Yisrael bnei adam shea oto hayom yom leidato. It would be their birthday. Now, what exactly does it mean that it was their birthday? So let me help you a little bit. This cannot be their Hebrew birthdays. Why? It has to be their quote-unquote Gregorian or secular or solar birthday. Why am I saying that? Because the Hebrew birthday is moon-oriented and moves across the solar calendar depending upon when the Jewish month is. But listen to what the Yerushalmi continues to say. Amalek was a kashvan. A person doesn't fall on their birthday. Moshe confused all the constellations. So hold it a second. And that's what he says, and that's what it means. Right, okay, we'll leave that. And there's a similar teaching in this, in a Medrash Tanchuma, which if you have to ignore the English, for Yehi Yadav Emuna Ad Bo Hashemesh, Hayu Machshavim Et Sha'ot Ba'Astrotologia, Me'asa Moshe, Hemid Galgal Chama U'Levana, Ve'Erav Et Sha'oteihem, that he messed up the constellations for them, and therefore it confused everything. The English over here explains it one way, and in Source 11, the Yad Tamar, Rav Yisachar Tamar, explains it a different way, but I'll just pause and say this again. Yes, the Ibn Ezra is trying to explain that Paro had a certain astrological sign, and therefore he was somehow limited in a particular way, which again seems to exactly be what our problem is. And he said, just looking back at source number 7, Ubavur koach haklalim yachlu l'shanot ma'at betolada. Which means essentially what he did with him is he left him back in the default of what his astrological disposition was and didn't allow him to make any changes which would have been difficult. I'm not sure why that is necessarily a lot better, and he had difficulty with other people's explanations, but maybe we can do the same thing that the Ibn Ezra just now did, but without astrology. But again, I'm just pausing for a moment. I hope you all understood the Yerushalmi that I just now referenced. The Yerushalmi is telling us that what Moshe did is he frustrated the ability of Amalek to manipulate the victory in the war based upon using people that it was their birthday by changing the constellations, and therefore the birthdays have to be solar birthdays, otherwise there's nothing to talk about in terms of constellations. Point made, hopefully understood. Again, the Ibn Ezra, he's claiming that what took place over here is that God does not allow him to go against what is his predetermined self, even though a person with great, and I don't want to finish that sentence right now, we'll say ability, can make those changes, which could be after the whole, everything is said and done, that the Ibn Ezra gives us more problems than he has solved. The Bechor Shor, now, he actually said three things there. In order to keep punishing him. Now, that actually that fits in pretty well with the Rambam. He deserves more punishment. If he deserves more punishment, I can't let him do tshuva yet because he deserves the punishment still. Lagdil shemi, but there's still something else that needs to take place. And maybe that lagdil shemi we'll have to explain still as we move on. Ulun kom nikmatami, and I need to take vengeance. Now, why these things and what is going on? These are two more elements. Again, this is a really short explanation, but I think it's very rich and we'll need to still understand it. Lagdil Shmi is because the Jews are in a culture, which the language of the Kabbalists is the 49th level of Tum'ah, that we have sung so much. There is all of these understandings on these forces in the world. There needs to be some type of a spiritual adjustment takes place in order for people to understand that, in fact, it is God who runs the universe, which means specifically in Egypt with Paro as a self-styled God and all of the Avodah Zarah which is there, there is this added necessity, Lahagdil Shemi. And that's meaning what he just now said. Again, three different phrases here. Larbot Makot Makoti Alav, he deserves to be punished. Lagdil Shmi, he's saying, is because the Jewish people are going to need to know that, you know, with clarity, that there is one monotheistic God. Ulim kom nikmat ami, in order to take vengeance upon them, so that we still need to understand where that is coming from. The Ramban in this particular instance, actually, you know, we're so used to the Ramban going after the Rambam and attacking him. In this particular instance, he's pretty supportive of the Rambam. But before we read him, I do want to go back a second again to that Rashi, because I told you that Rashi had much more than we perhaps realized. What does Rashi say over here? One, v'galui lefnei she'in nachat ruach b'umot latet lev shalem lashuv. That he say, no, it's they don't really want this, so that part of it we're not exactly sure. Vitakiru atem et gvurati, in the second line Rashi. Now you realize that was the same point that was made by the Bechor Shor, who of course is following Rashi, is that we need to know that there is one God. Kadesha Yishmu Yisrael Viro, that there is this element that the Jews need to know. But then he gets this other thing at the end, Vafal Pikin Bachamesh Makot Arishonot. And that we need to come back to still, and the Ramban is going to help us now to understand these other elements within Rashi. The Ramban, Vaneik Shalev Paro, in source 13, Amru B'Medrash Rabba. So let's stop right there. Before we read him further, let's look at the Medrash Rabba that he's referring to. Source 15, Davar Acher, Kini Ichbarati Et Libo, I hardened his heart. Amru B'Yochanan, Mikan Pitchon Pe Laminim Lomar Lo Haytam Imenu She'asa Tshuva. That this is going to allow all kinds of heretics to say, I do bad in this world because God doesn't allow me to do good. Which means when they realize that it says in the Torah that God took away Paro's free will, they're all going to say, I don't have free will. Meaning, why should a person try to do good when they feel drawn towards bad and saying, God never gave me the choice. This is who I am. And he says, this is terrible. Rabbi Yochanan is saying, this is terrible. Shenema ki ani ichbarat libo. Amar lo Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. And let's remember something. It's always interesting, the dynamic between the two. Those of you who are fortunate enough to read my book, Crowns and the Letters, where I have a chapter about Reish Lakish and his relationship with Rabbi Yochanan, so this is going to fit in as well, that Rabbi Yochanan is the tzaddik, you know, all the way through, and Rav Shimon ben Lakish, Reish Lakish, is the Baal Tshuva. And Reish Lakish says, oh, this guy's going to make an excuse? Yisatem piyem shaminim. He goes, shut the mouths of the heretics. I don't want to hear people making excuses. Elaim leitzim, if you're dealing with jokers, hu yalitz. So what does God do? God treats a joker in a joking manner. Now, we didn't follow that yet. God treats people according to the way that a person wants to be treated. So I'm going to say that one more time, because I don't think I'm reading too much into this. Im leitzim hu yalitz. When you're dealing with a leitz, God allows the leitz to be a leitz. Now, go back to that Rashi that we still were not completely sure about how to read. One of the things that Rashi said there, Galui Lefanai, She'ein Nachat Ruach Ba'umot Latet Lev Shalem Lashuv. They don't really want to return. Which means, let's go back for a second and consider this. You have this individual who is a polytheist, who very much is enjoying his polytheistic manner of life. And then suddenly a monotheistic God uses this incredible type of leverage on them, and therefore tries to convince this individual that they need to change their ways one way or another, again, by using the leverage. Is this what they want? Which means they want to remain in their pagan ways. They don't want this. So now go back to what Reish Lakish said. In the late Simhu, Yalitz. Shekodesh Baruch Hu matrebo ba'adam pam rishona shnia ushlishit ve'enu chozer bo. V'hu noel libo min atshuva kidei lefro imenu ad mashachata. And now you suddenly realize that the Rambam's explanation that at times people lose their free will is exactly what Reish Lakish has already said in this midrash. But it's interesting. You have one or two or three times, and then that's it. Afkach paro harasha. Paro, the wicked Paro. Kevin Shigera Kodesh Baruch HaMesh Pamim. Below Shkiyach HaDvarav. God sent him five. Now Rashi, going back one more time, Rashi had also mentioned that magic number of five along the way. right towards the very end. V'afo pikein b'chamesh makot rishonot lo ne'amar v'chazek Hashem et leif paro. Let's go back to the midrash because now we realize that is where Rashi was getting it from. That he says that chamesh pamim v'lo shkiach adverav amal kodesh baruch hu atah hiksheita arpecha v'chbadata libcha harenu mosif lecha tuma al tuma. I am going to increase the impurity upon the impurity, which, by the way, is what this is Reish Lakish still speaking. This is what do you do to a leitz? You give him more leitzanut, which means what is he saying? Have, therefore it means, ki ani hichbadati at libo, mao hichbadati, shosok HaKadosh Baruch Hu libo ki kaved. So now we lost it, and this should have been my previous class about cooking. He turned his heart into a liver. And so on and so forth, using a metaphor in terms of liver and so on. Stop and leave that for a second, and let's understand what it is that Reish Lakish is trying to teach us. He's saying that God treats a person the way that they truly want to be treated. What does Paro want in his heart of hearts? I'll give you two possibilities. Does he want to let the Jews go free because he believes that every person has a right to freedom? Or does Paro want to keep his slaves forever? So you get to vote on this. What's the right answer? He wants to keep his slaves forever. That's what he wants. But what's the problem? The problem is God is picking on him. God does one plague and a second plague and a third plague and a fourth plague and a fifth plague. And that's not nice and that's not fair. So when God does so many plagues and God is hurting him so much, what does Paro really want? Paro wants to keep his slaves. What is God doing? God is intimidating him. Now remember what I said before. God intimidated Avimelech and God intimidated Lavan. And over here, Paro is getting intimidated. So what does God do? What does God accomplish when he hardens his heart? It's actually just now flipped on its head. What does God accomplish when he hardens his heart? He gives Paro the ability of doing that which he really wanted to do. And therefore, the hardening of the heart is not taking away the free will. The hardening of the heart is actually what gives him his free will. Because now he's able to do what he really wanted to do in the first place. And, Michael, I see you enjoyed that. And that's just an unbelievable insight, because not only does the problem disappear, it's again, 100, don't say 360 degrees, then we're back where we started, it's 180 degrees. It's just, the problem just now became the solution. There's no problem here whatsoever. And it seems to be that the Rambam jumped off to the middle of that point, is that God takes away their free will, and Rambam says, oh, that's the punishment, they lose the free will. Well, what Reish Lakish seems to be saying is that God is going to treat a person the way they want to be treated. And now if we go back to that Rashi, he says, for the Umot Olam, for this kind of person, they don't want to come close to God. That's a nightmare for him. Which means Paro's nightmare is that he ends up becoming an Orthodox Jew, you know, like a rabbi in a Woody Allen movie, right? That's like the worst thing that can possibly happen to him. That's not what he wants. What he wants is to keep his pagan lifestyle and everything included his pagan lifestyle. He doesn't want anything else. So now you realize that just now became really much more interesting. And let's go back and now go to the Ramban, because the Ramban just now quoted that. Yeah, so that's interesting. What exactly is free will now? So God treats people in the way that they want to be treated. And that's what really becomes interesting, which means if I'm somebody who has, we're people who have this religious desire, but we mess up now and again, and we say to God, please help me, give me more strength. God gives you strength because that's what you really want. But the individual who doesn't want that, but part of what I'm getting at also is that now the book of Shemot, with all of these miracles taking place, has done something which is going to necessarily impact on the free will which Paro has because of this micromanaging taking place and all of these plagues and so on and so forth. So now let's go back and see what the Ramban wanted to tell us. Ramban says, V'niakshet leif Paro. And he says, Amri midrash rabba gilalo shehu atid lechazek et libo bavor lasot bo hadin, in order to punishment. Tachat Shavidam ba'avodah kasha, which means he deserves to be punished and we can't let him change because otherwise he won't get punished, which is something we've seen along the way here. and so on. Om Rav Yochanan, and he quotes Rav Shimon Lakish, and he quotes the whole Midrash here right in front of us. Vine, Pirisho b'sheila sheyishalu akol, regarding the question that everyone's going to ask, im Hashem ikshe et libo, ma pisho? If God hardened his heart, how is he responsible? V'yishmo shnei ta'amim, v'shneim emet. And there's two reasons, or two issues over here, and they're both true. Echad ki paro birisho asher asal Yisrael ra'ot gedolot chinam. Paro did so much evil without justification. Nitchev l'mo mimenu darkei ha'tshuva. It's proper that God takes away the ability to do tshuva. Kasher bo b'zeh b'psukim rabim b'torah v'ktuvim, as can be evidenced by many verses in the Torah and in all the writings, all of Tanakh. Ulafima asav rishonim nidon. And that was the part that, as I said, we also understood that in the Rambam, but the Rambam says it very clearly, and therefore he's only being punished for the earlier actions, but not for the ones afterwards. Vatama sheni. But regarding the second issue, or the second explanation, ki hayu chatzia makot alav v'pisha'o. Now again, regarding the first half and the second half, we already saw Rashi address that, and we saw the Midrash address it, and now the Ramban's going to address it. Ki lo nebaban rak v'chazek lev paro. Regarding the first five, it only says, and Paro hardened his heart. V'yichabed paro at libo. Paro kept hardening his heart. What does that tell me? What does Paro really want? He wants to harden his heart. And Paro, through the first five plagues, had the ability of standing strong and tall against God's plagues. He ne lo ratza l'shalcham l'chvod Hashem. He doesn't want to let them free. Aval kasher gavrua makot alav, when the makot became too strong, v'nalad l'sbol otam, and he can no longer deal with it. By the way, this is part of what the Ibn Ezra said, don't say. Rach libo, his heart got soft, and he already decided that's it. He has to let them free because of the power of the weight of the makot, of the plagues. Lo lasot ritzon baro, but he wasn't going to do it because he now wanted to do God's will. So what did God do? God strengthened him, gave him more gumption, right, in order to do really what he wants to do. But right there, the Ramban doesn't finish the sentence the way that I really want. Leman saper shemo, because God also has this other, there are other things that need to be done over here. Kinyan shekatuv v'tkadalti v'tkadashti v'no'adati le'negoyim rabim, which is the Haftorah, going to be for one of these parashot. V'shamar kodum ha'makot v'nechazek libo v'lishlach adam yodi l'moshe atid lasot bo makot achronot. So there's one more element going on over here, which the Ramban is adding, that which we're also going to have to understand. And he also says one more thing that I want, and this is as close as we're going to get to politics, and this is going to be great, because everybody can interpret anything you want in what I'm about to say. You can all think I said whatever you wanted me to say. Or even better, you can all think I said the opposite of you wanted me to say. You can all be upset with me now. But read the last line in the Ramban. Ki b'chamesh makot achronot gam b'tfi'at hayam ne'ma v'chazek ki lev melech b'yad Hashem al kol sheyichvot yitnu. This is a verse from Mishle. Pal gemayim lev melech b'yad Hashem al kol sheyichvot yitnu. What he just now added in as a side point, it almost sounded unimportant. He just now said that, yeah, people have free will, and free will is important, and God is going to do what you want to do, and so on and so forth. But what was the throw-in just now? That kings don't have complete free will because they control too much, and God controls the world. And when God has to micromanage, the best place to micromanage for his will to be done is to micromanage the hearts of kings. So it means that people in supreme positions of leadership have limited free will because certain things have to take place and God's will has to be fulfilled. And therefore, God will use them as pawns. It's very interesting. You think about the chess metaphor. It's pawns are kings because we have complete free will, and kings are pawns because they have to do certain things in this planet. So therefore, the Ramban just threw in this thought along the way that people in incredible leadership actually have far less free will than you or I do, because we have much less influence on people and much bigger processes need to take place. And as I said, anyone and all of you can do whatever you want with that sentence and apply it to any and every situation that you want to, and get upset with me as much as you like, as much as it makes you happy. Convinced that I said this or the other, but I most likely said the other. I don't think I said this. So let me go back then to the Chizkuni. Source 16. Vaniyaksha Perish Rashi, Bechamesh Makot Rishno, Lunam of Yechazek Hashem, Elevechazek Lev Paro. Okay, so that's less important to us right now. Right, so we'll go to, we're going to skip the Tzor Hamor, because I want to say actually the opposite of what he said, and we will instead go down to, I'll tell you what the Tzor Hamor plays with, but I just want to read it differently from him. He actually gives Paro somewhat of an excuse. You know, we had a previous Paro at some point, and the previous Paro, right, the one who met Yosef, Yosef convinces him to believe in God in a very short amount of time. God revealed to Paro what he's going to do, and then after Elohim, right here, the Paro, and afterwards says, "Who's have we seen such a man who has such ruach Elohim?" Which means that when somebody tells Paro that there is a God who says something which he likes to hear, suddenly Paro is a very big believer. But when somebody tells Paro something that he doesn't want to hear, then suddenly Paro says, I never heard of such a person, never heard of such a God. I have, you know, I'm who, why should I listen to him? So I'm just saying is that the comparison between the Yosef narrative, where Paro embraces that message that he has from God and God who controls the next 14 years of history, is very interesting when you compare it to this Paro. So as I said, that's the conclusion. We just have to ask ourselves, how much Paro do we have in our hearts? How much, you know, do we accept God only when God tells us things that we want, or we don't accept God when there are things that we don't want to hear? So I'm just saying that Tzmor didn't say that, but he got me to think about that. And you can look at him if you like afterward and see what he actually said, but he did not say that. He actually said there was a difference in the two narratives. There was Elohim, and here it's Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, and he makes a big deal about that. But let's move over to, let's see how much time, not that much time. Let's move over to this Chizkuni. This was the one that we wanted. So this Chizkuni is on Perek Dalet, Pasuk Kaf Aleph. What does it say in Kaf Dalet? What does the verse actually say over here? It says, this is back by the Sneh. And God says, okay, so here we have God saying, I'm going to harden his heart. Here the Chizkuni says, Chazak, he likes to say that a lot, because it's the Chizkuni. I'm going to harden his heart. He doesn't have a heart attack. Paro can drop dead from these plagues. These plagues are very disturbing. So God says, I'm going to harden his heart. He's saying I'm going to keep him healthy. So he's saying something really interesting, that he has to strengthen him. If, on the other hand, if you look at this Sforno, so it's actually two places. On this pasuk, he says a little bit, but not enough. Right? Is that he would have done something he didn't want to do. So that was really my point before about returning the free will, which I think we understood now from the Midrash, and we understood from probably even from Rashi, and we understood it from the Ramban as well. And the Sforno says it much clearer over here in source 28. We'll skip a little bit more. Now, they all play with the same thing, that there's something else going on. So let's just remember what else it is which is going on. The most important, over here, Shadalon 31, goes in a very similar way, and he quotes the Sefer Karim, Rav Yosef Albon 32. So we'll stop. In source number 33 is the most important prophecy in the book of Bereshit. So let's pay a little bit of attention to it, because this is actually the whole formula. This is the Brit Bein Haptarim, and the introductions have become numerous and so on. And then Pasuk Yud Bet is when the Eima Chashecha Gedola Nofelet Alav, this fear comes upon him. You're going to experience slavery. You're going to be abused. And I'm going to judge them And then you're going to leave with great wealth. By the way, the great wealth is already interesting because it says that when they leave, then you're going to ask to borrow things and the Egyptians are going to give you all kinds of things. That's also a suspension of free will. I just want to point out that this happens not only by hurting Pharaoh's heart, it happens in other elements over here as well. But you can ask, and I'm sure there are those who have, if it just now said that they're going to be enslaved, they're going to be abused, and then it says, Vagam asher goya, Asher avodu danonocha, and to judge them. Why are you going to judge them? They're apparently deserving of this. There are various answers that have been put forward to this. One answer is that, I mean, one claim is, who said it had to be in Egypt? Maybe it didn't have been in someplace else, but let's even say it was supposed to be in Egypt, which I think is not such a bad argument, being that the Avram Sarah visit to Egypt to a very great extent is foreshadowing a lot of the elements that happened here, including the males are threatened and the women are going to live, and then the plague strike, and then they're set free and they leave Ruchush Gadol. So it's very easy for me to say that Egypt was supposed to be. But there's another element over here. And the element is that it said they'll be enslaved and they'll certainly be abused. It never said anything about taking the children and killing them. It never said anything about taking the firstborn, about taking the Jewish kids and throwing them into the river. Throwing them into the Nile. That was not part of the Brit Bein Abeterim. So the judging them is going to be, let me see how bad they behaved. Which means it could have been, again, I'll say this on a theoretical level, it could have been a Paro can come and, that Moshe comes and says, let my people go. And when Paro says, sure, I've been waiting. I've been waiting for someone to say that. But even before that, remember, we saw that along the way. Once he says, Havanit Chakmalo, Bo, let's go and find the final solution for them. Let's now go and deal with them because we're afraid of them, which means that is the game changer over here. That is no longer abuse and that is no longer slavery. That is genocide. And that is something that needed to be judged. And it's interesting because what was actually the first plague that was introduced? The first plague, when I say introduced, on the table, what was the first plague that God had told Moshe about? And it's not the first plague that Moshe tells Paro about. It was when he tells him to go and tell Paro, let Israel go because they're my firstborn. I'm just looking for the pasuk. If you don't let my firstborn go, I'm going to kill your firstborn. Which means the quid pro quo over here of the makat becharot because of killing Jewish children along the way is something which we need to appreciate. And if we now begin to think about it, it's very, very likely that the idea of the 10th plague was always on the table, and it was always something which he deserved, and that was the actual punishment. And when I want you to notice something else, which we may have missed along the way. There was a phrase that was used in the very beginning, over here in source number one, and it says "V'lo yishma paro." Why? V'natati et yadi b'mitzrayim, and then it goes why? V'otzeiti et vatai why? And it says and. Right, Ami Bnei Yisrael Meretz Yisrael, Bishvatim Gdolim, with great judgments, which means there's a judgment that has to take place, and God is going to judge very, very carefully. See, it's interesting. You should be familiar with that phrase, because later on in the Dayenu we start, Ilu Otzimim Mitzrayim V'lo Asem Bishvatim Dayenu. It would have been enough. And I don't understand the song. I don't understand that phrase. It wouldn't have been enough. By the way, I don't understand any of them. I think that it's really trying to help us appreciate all the things that God did. The reason I understand it is because I'm going to judge them. And God has to judge them. If God judges them, then what happens? Then they become guilty. Which means part of the process over here is that the Egyptians, or certainly Paro, needs to be punished for all the terrible things that he did. And if Paro is going to be punished, then by definition, he can't back down at this point. Which means God made a covenant with Avram Avinu that the people who enslave you will be judged. And that judgment is contractual. So of course that has to happen, which means the suspension of the free will so that Paro won't back down in order to let them go too soon, that they won't be punished sufficiently. That's a part of the deal. So let's just now go back one more time and work out the various elements again. Paro could lose his free will, like the Rambam says, because that's the punishment. We went back to the Midrash and we realized it's the punishment, in the words of Reish Lakish, because that's what a person wants. A God will treat you as you want, and power wants to keep them. Power does not want to free them. God does not want to listen to God, which when we went back to Rashi, it was really there in Rashi as well. The other element is that power has presented himself as a God. The Jews have fallen for that as well, and they need to see all of this might of God along the way and need to see that God is actually far more powerful than Paro is in order for us to regain the type of belief that we're going to need in order to move forward. And finally, there's a contractual obligation to give the punishment to Paro, which he needs, which God has promised to Avraham. And that's why this whole scene cannot end too early. Rather, it has to end only after Paro gets the punishment to which he is deserving. And those are the various elements that we saw in this. And as I said, if you go back to Rashi, you'll realize, you know, Rashi, I'll say it again, does not get enough credit. But all of that was in that Rashi. And for some reason, we choose not to read Rashi properly, certainly not philosophically enough, or to deal with our great, you know, big problems or questions. We turn to the Rambam and other places, but it was all there. And in this case specifically, the teachings of Reish Lakish were really interesting, and that we realize how much influence that had on the others. And ultimately, we solved our problem about the free will, which I think all of you have now understood along the way, is that it wasn't that God took away his free will, is that God gave him the free will by virtue of hardening his heart and allowing him to do what he really wanted to do. And that's what's scary. What's scary is if God's really going to do what we really do for us, what we really want to do, and that could in certain cases turn out to be a terrible, terrible punishment, but that's what we really want. Which means it's one thing to do everything right, but at least our inner hearts, our inner souls need to be aligned with God's will. Even if we fail now and again, what we really want in our hearts of hearts has to be what God's will is, and then we have a chance of God leading us in that direction. People whose heart of hearts are going absolutely against God, God says, okay, you, like in the words of Reish Lakish, you're a Leitz, I'm going to help you be a Leitz. I'm going to help you. You're Tamei, I'm going to help you be more Tamei. That's what you want. I'm doing what you want. I am fulfilling your will. And that's, yeah, exactly. Be careful what you wish for. And that's exactly what takes place over here. And I think that, you know, once we go back and now think about how people raise the philosophical problem, maybe that's part of our problem. We were raised believing, look at this huge philosophical problem. And now we realize along the way how easy it was that it sort of just dissipated and disappeared.